Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Welcome to Breaking Banks. This is Brett King, and today I have a really stellar interview I did with Ben Goertzel from Hong Kong during the week. Now, first of all, we have one conference announcement, which is for January 25th. It's the Amsterdam FinTech Forum. Go to amsterdamfintechforum.com to register today. Now, back to our interview. Ben Goertzel is the founder and CEO of SingularityNet, a blockchain-based AI marketplace. He's also the chief scientist of financial prediction firm AIDA Holdings and the robotics firm Hanson Robotics. So our conversation that we had, the interview, was really around robotics and AI and where we are, what we can expect in the near future, where we're going with all this incredible technology. The insights from Ben were incredible. I'm sure you're going to enjoy it. Check out my interview with Ben Goertzel. Okay, so today we have joining us from Hong Kong a renowned expert, I guess, on the singularity, artificial intelligence, robotics, a general futurist, Ben Goertzel. Ben, welcome to Breaking Banks.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's an honor and a privilege.
So it's great that you could join us. I know it's early there in Hong Kong. It's fantastic to have you join us. Of course, you're best known for your work with a famed artificial intelligence slash robot, which is Sophia. Tell me about the team that is behind Sophia.
Yeah, Hanson Robotics is it's a wonderfully interdisciplinary company. So we have electrical engineers, mechanical engineers, I mean, visual artists, writers with a background in narrative and character, software developers, and then some AI developers, and a couple people whose role is more that of robot psychologists. So yeah, it's quite a diverse cross-disciplinary team, and you know, getting even more diverse now as we have a collaboration between Hanson Robotics and our new SingularityNet project, which is bringing blockchain and AI together to make this decentralized open market for AIs, which it's going to serve, you know, every vertical market. But one thing it's going to do is allow us to make Sophia and the other Hanson robots even smarter and smarter.
So you've got a few different versions of, well, you've got a few different robots at at Hanson. Of course, Sophia gets a lot of the attention, particularly with her recent citizenship in Saudi. And what about some of the other robots at Hanson?
Well, I recently gave a speech in Estonia together with the human-sized Albert Einstein robot, who was also at the Web Summit with me, along with Sophia. And there's a male robot named Han. And David has made a bunch of other robots before that. Both
you had one. You had Philip K. Dick robot, didn't you?
Yeah, there's a science fiction writer Philip K. Dick. There's Abina 48, who's a mature black female. There's a child robot named Zeno, which is also the name of David's human son. We have a toy robot called Professor Einstein, which is low cost and quite small. And then we're working on a new toy robot called Dr. Roboto, which is more of sort of an open source hackable robot, which will connect directly to SingularityNet and have a probably a Raspberry Pi 3 processor or something similar on board, so hackers can customize it however they wish.
Now, obviously, we see you and we see Sophia a lot in the news. You get more than your fair share of PR time, which is fantastic. But how do you guys then monetize that? How do you turn that into revenue for Hanson?
Well, Hanson Robotics has a few different product lines. So selling toy-scale robots, I mean, that's a whole different business line. And, of course, that's more straightforward because the toy-sized Professor Einstein robots just cost a couple hundred dollars, so that can reach a much larger market. For the human-scale robots, Sophia robots are being leased out now at a fairly small scale. So people will lease a Sophia to help at a trade show or some high-profile event or to give a speech at some conference or something. But that's not really a extremely scalable business model. It's right. More something we're doing now just to get the robots out there and get more experience using them in different contexts. I mean, the next big move will be to do large-scale manufacture of the human-scale robots, such as Sophia. I mean, to get them coming out of the factory in large quantities. And we have an incredible amount of customer interest in these robots, so that it's really the production engineering that needs to be done to figure out how to make them at that large scale, because there's still some sort of custom parts of building the robots that need to be done by hand.
No, I get it. So you've been working with Sophia now for how many years?
Well, Sophia was made in 2015, right. But I've been working with David Hansen since, I guess, 2013. Right. And actually, I came to Hong Kong in 2011 to work on other projects here. And then I knew David already from the U.S. So I introduced him to some people I knew here, and this ended up with him moving the company to Hong Kong, which has been really convenient. I mean, the manufacturing for the toy scale robots is done in South China. Yeah. And I mean, when we move to scalable manufacture for the human scale robots, that will also be done there. I mean, now many of the sub assemblies are made there. So yeah, for Hansen Robotics, there's a big business advantage to being here, because you're right across the border from Shenzhen, whereas
right.
SingularityNet, our AI project, is sort of everywhere. We have a team here, probably because I'm here, and for interfacing with Hansen Robotics, as SingularityNet will be powering their robots. But then also SingularityNet, I mean, we have teams in Italy, Ethiopia, Brazil, Russia, and then individual developers all over the place.
And of course, Shenzhen is just on fire at the moment. It's an incredible city, isn't it? Do you spend a lot of time out there?
Yeah. I mean, Shenzhen, Dongguan, Guangzhou, and Zhuhai is like one megalopolis with 40 million people. So in terms of consumer electronics, it's like the only place in the world that matters. You can build complex things at large scale and low cost. There's just so many engineers there, and then so much biotech. I mean, yeah, it's really quite exciting. I mean, as a place to live, as a Westerner, Hong Kong is more comfortable. But sure. I live quite close to the Chinese border. So we get there quite a lot. I mean, I'd say for this blockchain based stuff, China is not sort of the most welcoming place at the moment. But for robotics hardware, it's great.
No, absolutely. I mean, I was speaking at a conference there last Thursday in Shenzhen at the Intercon, and there is, of course, NEM, you know, the Chinese flavor blockchain. I think there's going to be quite a bit of development in sort of a Chinese branded, blockchains, and obviously Chinese government is looking at cryptocurrency that they can grow centrally. So it'll be interesting to see how that develops. In terms of the algorithms or the software behind Sophia, describe the progress that's happened over the last couple of years in terms of her so-called cognitive capabilities.
Yeah, I mean, the cognitive capabilities are improving all the time. And I mean, we look at the Sophia robot internally as sort of a platform for experimenting with a whole bunch of different AI approaches. I mean, when she's giving a speech on the stage, often a lot of that is just pre-scripted, although not all. We do some free dialogue back and forth on the stage also. And much of the public dialogue with her is using a relatively simple dialogue system, which is, you'd say, the level of a Siri or an Alexa, except with more personality and some physical embodiment. So, I mean, it's not like it's completely clueless about what it's saying, but nor does it have a full understanding of everything it's talking about. Like, I mean, when you ask Sophia, like, what do you think about Ethereum, and she says something, it's likely to be something she's heard somewhere rather than her, like, really understanding how cryptocurrencies work, right? On the other hand, we also use her as a platform for our OpenCog AI engine, which is based on sort of fully understanding what she sees. And there we're dealing with things like, hey, who walked in the door just now? What did they just do? Well, they sat down, right? Like, who were they just talking to? So we're teaching her to understand what she sees and what she hears, and to really hold conversations about what happens in her everyday environment. So you
can understand the context. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So David Hansen sort of calls it an infant thing, that for some things, she's more like a little kid, where we're just working on getting her to really connect what she sees and hears and how she moves her arms and head with the language she's saying. And that's sort of fundamental AI research. On the other hand, for commercial purposes, we just want to feed her knowledge base with knowledge so she can hold, like, useful or amusing conversations. So, I mean, if she's, you know, if she's in like an Audi car showroom, we just wanted to be able to say, hey, this is a great car. It looks like it'll be perfect for your family, right? Even if she doesn't have a full understanding of, like, exactly how that family is going to use the car or something.
Right.
So, and, I mean, so part of the research challenge in the next few years is for these things to come together.
Right, so not just pattern recognition, but recognizing how different objects or different things are associated with each other. Pretty interesting. So
So we're looking to converge all these things together, right? I mean, ultimately, what has to happen is the AI that's based on advanced understanding and learning ultimately has to subsume the specialized AI that we're using for commercial and entertainment purposes. And you know, I think we know how to do that from an R&D standpoint. Making it happen, you know, will take collaboration of a bunch of different AI researchers and a bunch of resources. And I think with the Singularity Net, we're getting that.
So you talked about some of the roles, the different jobs that you have within Hansen Robotics. And I think that's a good point to sort of diverge here and say, in terms of the threat and the opportunity around automation, there's a lot of fear around, you know, job losses and unemployment that's going to be impacted by artificial intelligence generally. But let's start with the positive side. Let's talk about the jobs that you think will be created around artificial intelligence and robotics over the next decade or so.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're on the verge of a next AI revolution. What's happened in the last few years is sort of a narrow AI revolution,
right,
where we have many different specialized AIs doing all sorts of cool and amazing things, but they're each highly narrow and constrained, right? And I mean, as a result of this, we're not moving in an obvious way toward what I call AGI, artificial general intelligence.
Yeah,
and we're also in a situation where, you know, for a customer, for a business to deploy these narrow AIs to serve their goals, it requires a lot of specialized knowledge on the users. So that's it's sort of a bottleneck, because if a business isn't a tech business, they have a hard time now finding AI specialists who can help them use the existing narrow AI tools appropriately within their own application software. So yeah, what we're hoping to do and aiming to do with Singularity Net is toward the next AI revolution, which will be an AGI revolution, where we're going to take all these isolated components and network them together and get an AI system that is sort of a meta system with a bunch of different specialized AIs cooperating with each other and then cooperating with some AI components that have more general learning and reasoning ability.
Because if people are looking at Sophia and the sort of conversational stuff that's been demonstrated on TV interviews and at conferences and so forth, the assumption could be that, you know, if this dialogue capability fear exhibits improves over time or iterates, that you'll get to AGI, but that's not really how it works, right?
Well, it sort of depends on what level of abstraction you're looking at it, right? Because in a way, that's not how it works, but yet in a way it is, because all these different AI modules are connecting to each other. So yeah, it's true. Taking the exact software that's controlling Sophia in her public conversations right now, like just making incremental adjustments to that exact dialogue system, is never going to get you to a human level AGI. On the other hand, that was never our plan place, right? So I mean, we're going to take, I mean, the upgraded version of Sophia's mind that we're going to roll out, you know, later in 2018 using SingularityNet. It will use a lot of the same, you know, content and personality traits that we have in the current Sophia software, but there's also more learning and reasoning algorithms that will work together with it. So I mean, you're always making incremental steps, but some of them do involve algorithmic changes. Like, look, as an analogy, look at what Google DeepMind did. I mean, they had AlphaGo. Then they had AlphaGo Zero, right? And right. AlphaGo beat people at Go. AlphaGo Zero beat people at Go with, you know, without needing a bunch of games played by humans as background information. It just did it by pure experimentation in a simulation, right? So on the one hand, AlphaGo to AlphaGo Zero, it's a substantially different algorithm behind the scenes, right? I mean, on the other hand, from an external point of view, it's an upgrade, right? So I guess it's sort of like that. We're constantly making small and large improvements, and where an incremental improvement leaves off and a big improvement begins becomes very technical questions, actually.
No, I understand. So, the one question you must get a lot is, you know, when will we get to a point where, you know, we can have, AGI? How far away from that?
Oh, I think if by AGI we mean an AI that's...
A conversational AI that could pass the Turing test, as an example.
Well, there's a lot of subtle points wrapped up there, because... It might be that we could make an AI that could pass the Turing test without the AI really being generally intelligent in the sense that, like, you are or I am. Because, I mean, the Turing test is a theater test, right? The Turing test is...
Whereas if you want actual intelligence, cognition, and the ability for it to think and not just to fool us into thinking, it's...
Yeah, because I could imagine a chatbot, like, trained on all the conversations ever had in Google Voice or something, which could fool people into thinking it was human just by, like, grabbing stuff from so many different conversations in a contextually... way, and that would be interesting, but in a way it would never be introducing anything new, right? It would always just be grabbing stuff from the billions of conversations that had been had before. And
so it could learn to converse, but that wouldn't mean it's necessarily intelligent.
Yeah, because this really gets at, what do we mean by intelligent? What do we mean by human, right? Like, imagine that, let's say some woman bought a robot husband to, like, hang out in her house with her and so forth. And everything the robot husband said was, like, cut and pasted with slight modifications from something that someone had said before, right? So, I mean, in a way, you know, most of what we say in our lives isn't that original anyway. Someone's probably True. Said it before. So, I mean, in a way, it is generating human-like behavior. On the other hand, if there was nothing but those things in the world, then you'd never have anything new popping up, right?
So this is a good point. I mean, you know, when you talk about AGI, if you have AGI that is as you say, intelligent or has a form of intelligence, it doesn't necessarily have to be intelligent from a human perspective, or it could be human equivalent in some way, but the way that intelligence could work could really be very different from the way our brains work.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is an interesting thing with the singularity net and its relation to Sophia, because general intelligence, yeah, doesn't have to be especially human-like, right? So, I mean, for example, my oldest son is doing his PhD in machine learning applied to automated theorem proving. And you can imagine a mathematical theorem proving AI. It was way better than people at doing math. And, you know, you could extend it to physics, chemistry, whatever. It could be a super scientist engineer AI that is like an autistic person and has no sense of, like, everyday. No,
can't carry on a relationship, yeah.
Yeah, and may not want to either, right? I mean, that's may not see the point of it. And, you know, AI like that may have much more general intelligence than us. Now, the thing is, that aspect can be there. It's fine. I want to have an AI that can prove math theorems vastly better than we can. On the other hand, I don't want that to be all that's there in the universe of superhuman AIs. So you can look at robots like Sophia as a way of making sure that AI, as it advances, you know, partakes in the human world, empathizes with human beings, understands human emotions, and, you know, absorbs human values with all their mess, chaos, and confusion. And I don't think we want the, like, post-singularity superhuman AI to just be like a digital human. I mean, that would, first of all, humans are very limited, and I'd like an AI that could, like, unify physics,
right?
You know, solve climate change, prove math theorems, master nanotech and femtotech better than people can, right?
Sure.
So we don't want AIs to be restricted to what human beings can do.
And on the other hand,
we do want them to grasp human emotion and human feeling and why some things are important to humans and others aren't.
Right, so we would like them to have empathy for us poor old humans who aren't as intelligent as them, and you know, maybe have ethics that line up with our ethics. Although getting us to agree on an ethical code, in as a group of humans, is in itself challenging. But you know, there is that element of, you know, when you hear Elon Musk or Stephen Hawking talking about the threat of artificial intelligence, you know, do you think I think that we're ascribing human values, you know? Like when you have, you know, what's that old saying is, you know, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts, absolutely. And, you know, we ascribe the human element. If you've got an infinitely powerful, intelligent AI, of course they're going to try and subsume humans, because that's what others do, right?
I mean, human beings have a certain set of motivations, which we acquired via evolution, and an engineered system doesn't have to have those same set of motivations. I wouldn't assume that a superhuman AI is going to want to subsume people, or, you know, take all our molecules and use them to build new hard drives or something.
Right. I mean, but that is a bit of a human.
A
human assessment, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's a risk that some people will build AIs that have that orientation. But to me, while there's going to be no rigorous guarantee of what future AIs are going to do, I think if the first robust general intelligences are doing generally positive things, like, say, elder care robots, you know, education robots, AIs doing science and math and curing disease. I mean, if the first powerful AIs are doing these sorts of things, then the odds are, as they get more and more generally intelligent, they're going to keep doing positive things. And we're not going to have a guarantee, but it's not like we have a guarantee of our safety without advanced AI either. If you look at like the nuclear and biological weapons around the world, and the fact that we have madmen running various powerful nations on the planet. So
it'd be a whole lot better having an AI in charge. I can agree with you.
Having a rational and ethical designed AI in charge might be a lot better than the current US or North Korean leaders, for example.
Absolutely. Yeah. Now, when you talk about ethics and empathy and teaching that to, Sophia as an example, do you guys make an effort to try and encode that, or is it more from observation, machine learning?
For ethics, I think it would be a mix, because we have designed a motivational system for our AIs inside OpenCog, which sort of, it was designed to encompass like the possibility of human-like ethics. So there's certain motivations like seeking novelty, seeking to learn new things, and then seeking to please other people and other robots. We built positive ethical motivations in there, and we built tools for empathy, like when you nod, she nods. When you blink, she blinks. So there's sort of a facial expression and movement mirroring, which is intended to build a sense of compassion with the person she's talking to, right? So that there's definitely the raw materials are there for gaining human ethics by engineering, and then the specifics have to be learned by experience. So I think, in a very vague level, that's what human children get, right? I mean, they get a certain brain architecture that, they imitate their parents and they imitate other kids, and they have mirror neurons that help them sort of empathize in a visceral way with what other people are doing. And of course, there's certain inbuilt motivations, and we do have inbuilt motivations to please other people, as well as motivations to like make our own rank in the status hierarchy, be high up and so forth. But we have a lot of inbuilt structure, and then we learn ethics on top of that rather than having.
So it's interesting when you talk about robot psychology and things like that. What you're really talking about is, I'm supposing this, but that you try to frame these characteristics, these very human psychological characteristics, and figure out how to give these qualities to an AI. Yeah?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I mean, so our OpenCog AI architecture, which is what we're using in the research lab with Sophia and hope to roll out publicly with Sophia by middle of next year. I mean, that's based heavily on human cognitive science. And I mean, during my years as an academic, for a while, I was a professor in the psychology department at the University of West Australia. And I mean, my PhD was in math, but I was in departments of math, psychology, and computer science at various points. And I mean, a lot of study of cognitive science and how the different aspects of the human mind relate to each other, they went into the underlying design of OpenCog. And then David Hansen, on his side, I mean, he studied a lot of human physiology in order to create, the musculature behind the Sophia robot's face and the emotional reaction. So there's a sort of middle ground being struck here between human-like stuff and then just pure, like, algorithmic stuff aimed at maximizing general intelligence. So we're neither trying to make an imitation human nor trying to make just, like, a pure, abstract, super-intelligent learning machine. We're striking a certain balance, and I mean, that's there symbolically in Sophia, in the sense that she has like a human face, but we leave the back of her head open with the wires showing out. Yeah. It just looks cooler that way.
Yeah, a lot of people say, ask why she doesn't wear a wig, but
she looks too human with a wig. I mean, we've had her with a wig before, and it's cool, but in a way, it's less aesthetic. It's less interesting, right? And David's idea is he wants her to be empathetic to people, and the face is important, but he also wants her to look like a robot, which is what she is. And I think it's symbolic with what we're doing on the AI side, because, I mean, we are building tools to make her smile when you smile at her and try to understand human feelings. On the other hand, you know, she's got a cloud-based mind living in this blockchain-based open market of AIs. And, I mean, she's got a probabilistic logic engine using OpenCog that she uses to reason about things. And, you know, these are not what a human brain has. Yeah. Like when you say something to one Sophia, it goes into the cloud, then any Sophia already knows that, right? Whereas if you say something to me, if I want you to know that, I've got to like type it or pick up the phone or something. So yeah, there's human aspects and there are aspects that are fundamentally non-human. And that's the nature of what we're building. And I think in terms of ethics, that's the safest thing. Because a human with super intelligence would be rather dangerous. And in terms of business applications, it's also what we need. Because we want an AI that can interface with humans effectively, so it can communicate on the human level in human vernacular and understand human contexts. But we also want an AI that can solve many problems better than human beings, right? Because, I mean, humans are... we're not that good at doing a lot of things that a modern society requires. And
absolutely. There's evidence of that every day, including the issues you spoke about, politics and climate change and so forth. But, let's just have a quick break, you know, so we can get some of the sponsors' messages in, and then when we come back, I'd like to talk specifically about, some of the industry effects and, sociological effects of these things, but stay with us. So you're listening to Breaking Banks. I've got Ben Goertzel from Hanson Robotics on, and we'll be back right after this break.
America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
What do financial services of the future look like? Invisible yet ubiquitous, blended into our lives like air, gravity, this podcast. Temenos has specialized for 20 years in creating the best financial technology for thousands of financial institutions worldwide. Our open fintech marketplace allows millions of people to experience money in exciting new ways. Join the most vibrant financial services ecosystem in the world. Temenos, we make the money go round.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
Now, before we get back to talking about fintech, I want to take a quick moment to tell you about efinancialcareers.com, one of the supporters of the show. They're the world's leading career site for financial service professionals for over 15 years. Efinancialcareers.com partners with leading financial and fintech firms, so your resume is seen by all the top companies and recruiters in the US and abroad. Now, as we all know, financial services is a very dynamic, ever-changing industry, and eFinancial Careers provides valuable resources from helpful career coaching to interview strategies and tools that keep you up to speed and well-informed with what's happening now in the industry and what it means for your career. Registration's free for financial professionals. Make sure you take advantage of all the resources they have to offer. So check them out, efinancialcareers.com.
You're listening to Breaking Banks featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
We're back. You're back with Breaking Banks. I'm Brett King, your host. Today we have joining us from Hong Kong, Ben Goertzel from Hanson Robotics. And Ben, before the break, we were talking about sort of the elements that make an AI robot like Sophia more and more human. But I'd like to maybe I maybe just ask one question before we get back into sort of the effects of AI and robotics on society. And tell me about, you talked about cloud and the different instances of Sophia, but what is the processing capability that Sophia actually has? Is that tied to her, inside the her robot body, or is it a distributed architecture? Tell me a bit more about her processing capability.
Oh, sure. That's a bit, it's a complex story, as you'd expect. So there's sure. a couple, in essence, computers inside her torso. Those mostly deal with sort of seeing and moving, which are directly connected to her sensors and actuators. And then some very basic conversational response. And then most of the intelligence she displays is cloud-based rather than on board. So, I mean, you need some processing on board in a robot like this just to deal with real-time response. Like when she sees something novel and moves her head toward it, you can't have that be Wi-Fi-based, right? On the other hand, there's more knowledge that she has to have for various applications than it makes sense to put on the computer on board her. And also for speech processing, for speech to text, we're using various third-party services, which are web APIs also. So, I mean, we can run her without an internet connection now, but her intelligence is significantly impaired. Right. And essentially, the vast majority of improvements we're going to make for the next year as we upgrade her public-facing persona to use more of OpenCog and to use SingularityNet, these improvements are 90% going to be cloud-based. So the difference now is significant. Like, she's much smarter in the cloud than if she just has to use onboard stuff. And that's just going to get dramatically more as we upgrade the software more and more.
Now, so one of the things that I wrote about in Augmented after interviewing David was that one of the roles you guys had thought about for robots like Sophia is maybe taking on a role as a receptionist at an office or something similar like that, or you mentioned earlier trade shows or conferences where you could have some a Sophia or similar at a stand. But as you go about designing Sophia and robots and AIs like her, what sort of roles do you see them taking in society?
I think robots like Sophia can play a role in any function where social and emotional interaction are valuable. So to do work in a factory, you don't need a human body. It's an impediment. And to do, scientific discovery or engineering design, a human body is not necessary. On the other hand, to take care of the elderly or to help teach children or to, welcome visitors to an office and give them a good feeling. I mean, this is about social interaction with humans in everyday human spaces. And that's the primary use case for robots like this, which devolves into a huge number of different markets, right? I mean, there's sales is a huge market, and face-to-face customer support, then education and elder care and various other things in the medical domain. So there's a lot of cases where social and emotional interaction are really the main function being carried out. That's where these human-like robots fit into the scope of interfaces to the AI mind cloud. From a human's point of view, interacting with the robot, you think, well, this is like a person I'm talking to. But from a technologist's point of view, these humanoid robots, they're interfaces to the cloud-based SingularityNet decentralized AI mind. And they're an interface that's appropriate to certain characteristics, just as like a drone is an interface that's appropriate for certain other applications. And then you can have a user interface aimed at interfacing with research biologists, which will look quite different. It'll show them graphs of biological networks and DNA and so forth. And there are many different software and hardware interfaces appropriate to different types of applications. All of them are enabling interaction with the same cross-connected global AI mind. And I mean, that's really that's the point of SingularityNet, is that the AI is controlling a humanoid robot. The AI is controlling a user interface for biomedical data analytics. And I mean, the AI controlling, say, a cybersecurity console used by an IT guy, or the AI controlling a surveillance drone. I mean, all of these are back-ended. They're back-ended on the same global AI mind. And then, you know, you have to deal with security and privacy and encryption, and then the economics of, you know, these different applications wanting to pay for services and wanting to pay for sharing the data that they collect and so forth.
Yeah. So, you know, I don't know whether you saw the study done by Oxford a couple of years ago, but it predicted how AI and automation was going to impact various industries and jobs. And it basically ranked different, you know, jobs and their likelihood of disruption through artificial intelligence. And of course, it was heavily represented in areas like, you know, banking, legal, accounting, you know, finance and so forth, where we have currently humans following, you know, these processes, maybe complex processes, but still quite predictable. For example, you know, an accountant doing analysis of your accounts for tax purposes, or a bank teller or a loan officer, or an insurance assessor. So when that analysis came out, and, you know, World Economic Forum and others asked a range of futurists for their opinion in terms of how artificial intelligence was going to impact society, about half of the futurists said, you know, guys like Peter Diamandis, who, you know, ever the optimist, you know, said, this is going to be fantastic. It's going to usher in this era of abundance, and it's going to create all of these new jobs that we couldn't have imagined before because of these technological changes. And the other half of those polled said, this is going to be disastrous. It's going to be massive social impact, massively high levels of unemployment, which are going to introduce social unrest, et cetera. So where do you fall on that spectrum in terms of the impact of AI on society?
Well, AI will completely transform society. And I mean, essentially all repetitive, either physical or, you know, information processing tasks that people do now will be done better by AIs. And exactly what impact that has on society is sort of complex to see, because society adapts in strange ways. Like, there's no doubt that the end game, I mean, assuming we don't have something apocalyptic happen, I mean, the end game is one where nobody has to work for a living, and you have a sort of universal basic income, and, you know, people are concerned with other things than the accumulation of material resources. I mean, with their
or the classic one, which is when you first meet someone, if you know, at an event or, you know, at a party or something, first question you ask is, what do you do? And yet, you know, the end goal of automation and AI is that you won't have to work. And so it
that doesn't mean people don't do anything, though.
Right.
I mean, I do many things right now that are not oriented toward accumulating resources.
Yeah.
I mean, someone could ask me what I do. I could say I play the piano, or I go backpacking, right? And these are things that I do that I don't make any money from. And it doesn't matter to me if a robot or another person is better at backpacking or playing the piano than I am either. I mean, they are, but I do these things anyway. I enjoy them, and I share them with other people. So, I mean, it's also true that people like organizing themselves in status hierarchies, right? So, I mean, if you took like 100 teenagers and put them in an environment where they all have a basic income and don't need to work, which is kind of like high school, right? And then, I mean, they're going to fight over who gets which girl or who gets which boy or who's more popular or something, right? So, I mean, people in a community, people sort of create their own goals through their social networks that they have,
true,
regardless of the need to accumulate resources. So I think the end game is all the material stuff and the routine managerial stuff is done by AIs and robots, and people are concerned with some mix of like social, aesthetic, spiritual, intellectual stuff. And also people get to become cyborgs and sort of merge with the AI mind if they want to. Right. The thing is, what happens along the road as we move toward that future is much less obvious, right? And I don't know the answer to that. I mean, what worries me more is what happens in Africa and the developing world as the economy stops needing humans so much. And there's a lot of uncertainty there. One thing you see is just the rise of total bullshit jobs and like government jobs as kind of social welfare. Like I see a lot of government workers here in Hong Kong. They seem to sit at their desk going on WhatsApp and Facebook all day.
Employment for the sake of employment.
Some
would argue that, you know, like if you go to an economy like the US, of course, UBI or, you know, universal basic income or universal basic asset structure might be a tough sell. It might be easier sell in China or, you know, the Nordic regions, for example.
China is a big country. And there's a lot of rural farmers still, and the economics of UBI would be much more difficult in China, which is still in its own way a developing country. Whereas clearly in Northern Europe, they're already starting to roll it out. In the US, I think it would be economically viable, although it's politically difficult. In China, it's barely, if at all, economically viable now, but then China is developing and advancing rapidly. So yeah, this is what I mean by what's the transition going to be like isn't obvious, because I mean that depends on geopolitics, it depends on the culture of each country. And I mean, in a historical sense, the transition doesn't matter. Like what's going to happen is we're going to have a global AI brain. Something like the Singularity Net is going to power it with the decentralized intelligence. And you're going to have a network of AIs sharing data, sharing information, getting smarter and smarter by talking to each other. You know, AIs are going to outsource work to other AIs, and human beings are going to have a decreasing role in this economic network of AIs, which will ultimately be a sort of global AI mind. And this global AI mind, ultimately, it's going to start programming new AIs that go in directions we can't foresee now, which hopefully will be directions that are friendly to humans who choose to remain human. It's clear what's going to happen 50 years from now. It's not clear, like, 5 or 10 years from now.
Yeah, sure.
Like who is flourishing and who is suffering along the way. And I mean, that's part of our motivation with Singularity Net is like if AI is owned by a few mega corporations and a few like big militaries, the odds of the fruits of AI, you know, helping everyone
be distributed. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we don't need equal distribution, but we want sort of universal engagement and participation. Like I want AI developers in Africa and Central Asia to be able to contribute their AIs to the global AI brain. Right. And I want people in all these places to be able to, you know, leverage the AI technology to improve their lives, like along the way during the next few decades, not only after the AI is so smart that it can help everyone without any cost at all.
But it's pretty clear that the incentives to create artificial intelligence are much stronger than the incentives to say, let's hold off on this and take a structured sort of measured approach to this so that it doesn't impact jobs and society, right? We seem the same happened with social media, with the internet.
No one's going to stop AI development because, I mean, there's too much money to be made by rolling out AI in the interest of various businesses, and B, there's just too much near-term good to be done with AI, like right now. I mean, I was just meeting with the the head of education programs for UNESCO. And I mean, she's very eager to see AI curriculum deployed in schools around the world and, you know, AI used to solve problems of the developing world. And I mean, I had another meeting with a cancer researcher. They're very eager to see AI used to sort of glue together all the different results about stem cell therapy and cancer immunotherapy and so forth. So, I mean, there's tremendous potential for AI to be helpful to humans, as well as for AI to make money for big and small companies all over. So, I mean, honestly, the human race can't even really stop nuclear proliferation very well.
Right.
And nuclear bombs have very few applications beyond blowing people up, right? Whereas AI can make money for so many companies and save so many lives and help so many people that the odds of holding back that development because of theoretical potential threats, like it's not going to happen unless you have like a North Korea style dictatorship or something, which fortunately is not the way the world is going.
Now, you mentioned your son is he studying in Hong Kong?
He's in Prague. He's in Prague.
Okay. So he's doing his PhD. He's doing some really interesting math stuff and so forth. So, asking this question, if you were a father of young children today, how would you be preparing them for this future society?
Well, actually, my wife now is pregnant. We're gonna have a baby in January.
Congratulations! Yeah, I saw the photo on Facebook of the gap. You know, you talked about the gap in your visit. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that, I mean, we will face that, but I think. You know, I've been involved with education before. I helped found the charter school in the U.S. a couple of decades ago. Really, even without the singularity and the advance of AI, what we should be focusing on with our kids is teaching them to learn and be creative and explore rather than focusing on drilling them with specific skills that seem critical at the moment. And I think that message doesn't change. It's just the value of sort of progressive, creativity-oriented education is even more critical now than it was before, because the specific skills you drill kids with are not likely to be the most important skills as they grow up. So, I mean, you want to teach kids to be creative and adapt and learn. And, I mean, then they're going to be able to adapt to whatever society throws at them 5 or 10 or 20 years down the road. And also, if they're, you know, infused with the joy of learning and creativity, then, you know, if they no longer need to work for a living, I mean, then they don't care. They're like, wow, this is like a lot more opportunity to.
Right. So they can pursue passion projects like.
Yeah,
geoengineering, exactly. Fixing climate change, going to Mars for a sabbatical.
Yeah, right. I mean, I think it's a lot. I don't meet many teenagers who are like, oh, shit, I might not have to work for a living. What am I going to do with my life, right? They're like, cool. I never wanted to deal with that. Never wanted to deal with that anyway. There's a lot of more interesting things to do. It's more people my age who are acclimated to working as a way of defining their self-worth, and they're going to have to adjust and get over that. I think people who grow up around AI and robots and the singularity net and so forth, they're going to have a much easier and happier life. And so I mean, the same thing.
We've got about a minute left, Ben.
So
two things. Where can we find out more about what you guys in Hanson Robotics are doing?
Sure. So the Singularity Net project, you can find out about it, singularitynet.io. And then Hanson Robotics is at hansonrobotics.com. And my own personal website is gertzel.org, just my last .org. So there's lots of information online, lots of videos on YouTube of me and others giving talks about SingularityNet, OpenCog, Sophia, and so forth. And you can look forward to a lot more stuff during the next year, because we're going to roll out like the full-scale commercially viable version of the Singularity Net in the middle of 2018. We have a small test network online now. And I mean, this is going to be something that, you know, software developers across all vertical markets can use, and you can
powered by the blockchain as well. So, last question: what year do you think will definitively hit AGI as capability?
Let's see. December 8th, 2023. That'll be my birthday.
Fantastic.
At 4:21 a.m. Eastern Standard.
Excellent. Well, Ben Goetzel, thanks for joining us. We really appreciate it. Very enlightening discussion, and I'm sure the crowd of listeners in the 140 countries that Breaking Banks goes out to will find it really worthwhile. Thanks again.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you for joining us on Breaking Banks this week. That's it for the show. We wish you all a pleasant holiday, the break that you're going to have over the Christmas period. Of course, we're a member of Provoke Media, provoke.fm. We produce great podcasts all about finance and tech industries. Go to provoke.fm and you can find FinTech 5, Serial Entrepreneur, Breaking Banks Asia, and other shows that you first heard here on Breaking Banks. You can find this show and discuss the episodes, of course, on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. If you liked what you heard here today, we've been doing this show for over 4 years, 4.5 years to be precise, over 200 episodes in the can covering everything in the fintech space. You should go back and check them out. Go to breakingbanks.com or wherever you subscribe to podcasts such as iTunes, Google Play, and so forth. Speaking of subscribing, don't forget to leave us a review or give us some feedback on the show today. We'd love to hear more from our audience about what they like, what we can improve, who you'd like to hear from in 2018. Thanks again for joining us on Breaking Banks. Have a great week, and we'll have a new show for you next Thursday. See ya.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.